All right, everybody, welcome back to Writer Stuff. I am back with Mr. Jeff Circle. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, everybody. I'm great.
And tonight we have the pleasure of talking to Megan Beattie of NBC Communications, a renowned book publicist working on both the East Coast and West Coast at some point, correct? You're out of LA now?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Megan Beattie. I've been doing book PR for, I think this is my 28th year.
Wow.
Started in New York as a little assistant and clawed my way up. And then, left New York and started my own company in Los Angeles.
So you started at age 12. Okay, got it.
Check. I thought they had child labor laws in New York. I grew up there.
28 years. Wow, you must have stories.
I've got so many stories.
Oh.
Many. Most I can't share publicly, but I've got stories for sure. Really? One day I'll write a book. I'll write my
Tell
own book.
All.
Yeah, I'm. Well, as you know, you give us that 28 year period. I'm thinking of all the different names that have come and gone in that time. Nonfiction set aside, because that's kind of. I mean, there's massive things there, but in the fictional world, like I'm thinking, I started with Clancy and Benchley, and then you know there's Mitch Rapp, and then all the different just superstars that just come up out of that. That's a whole lot of history.
That's a great point, and I'll give you a good example of that. So my first year in publishing, I was working at Putnam. I was an assistant to the executive director. I was basically a glorified secretary, like doing old stuff that's really old school now, like typing memos and opening mail and trying to keep her life organized. And at the time, Putnam published so many big authors. I mean, Tom Clancy, Alice Hoffman, Robert Parker, just massive, Patricia Cornwell, massive names. And a manuscript came across my boss's desk, and she said, "We're going to publish this guy, and you know, you might want to. Why don't you read it and check it out?" And I read this book, and I was like, "Oh, this is going to be big." And then I saw the cover that Putnam had designed, and it was just stunning. It was an all-white cover with a bloody handprint, and it was The Killing Floor by Lee Child. And that, I mean,
called it,
you know, I read it and I was like, holy caca, this is going to be something. So yeah, I mean,
wow.
All those years ago.
Well, that's a great jumping off point. Cause I've got my list of very scribbly notes, to chit chat about, but, in the industry as it is, and even, when you're in that entry level job, you're pretty much just trying not to get yelled at and do whatever somebody tells me to.
Yeah.
But the overall culture, like, can you see a first run manuscript of The Killing Floor come in? And is there a trajectory already in the mindset of the publisher? Or is it like, that one's pretty good, let's see where it goes? Like, what's a strategy? Or is there a strategy?
Yeah, I mean, well, if you're asking about way back in the day, you know, there were definitely, I remember there would be books that would come into Putnam, and it would be, you know, for whatever reason, there was a huge advance, but it was like all hands on deck, and the publicity departments were massive, not like it is now. I mean, they were, you know, especially for a house like Putnam, so many people, and it was like all hands on deck, we're going to make this book a New York Times bestseller. And that was really what Putnam did. You know, one of my many jobs as an assistant back in 1996 was the New York Times bestseller list would come over on the fax machine at 5:30 every Wednesday to Putnam. And it would be like, it would like roll off in that weird fax paper, and there'd be all these pages, because there'd be the hardcover fiction and the hardcover nonfiction. And there were actually many more lists than there are now. They've sort of distilled those down. But I would go through the lists and pull all the Putnam titles off and collate and figure out like how many book Putnam published that had been on the list in how many weeks. And they had, you know, so many.
Just a hit machine.
Yeah, but you know, I literally had 1 year in-house in my career, and then I went to an agency, a freelance agency called Goldberg McDuffie Communications. And back in 1997, it was very unusual for an author or a publisher to hire another company to come in and do the publicity, because as I said before, like publishers had these incredibly robust publicity departments. So they were able to do all these big books in-house, but once in a while they would, for whatever reason, there might be like a lot of complicated moving parts to a book, and they would hire this agency I went to called Goldberg McDuffie. And so I ended up working with, so Lynn Goldberg and Camille McDuffie were the two heads of this agency, and they were incredible role models and brilliant publicists and really, really keen to teach a young publicist like me the ropes, and to let me ask questions and make mistakes and learn from those mistakes, which was not my experience working at Putnam. It was very much like, if you make a mistake, you're going to be publicly humiliated in front of the whole department. But that's another story.
Well, that's that actually, I mean, it's so lucky to get that, to be young and to find somebody who's willing to watch you stumble and help you instead of just sink you and stab you in the back. But I wanted to, and I'm sure there's more to talk about there, but when you said that it was your job to take the New York Times facts
in the night, should we explain that for those?
Yeah, there was such a thing that was like a printer, but it was attached to the phone line. It made really funny noise, and then a document would come out, and it was dotted, and it had like little circles and little holes on the side, and just wheeled itself out, and then you ripped it off and looked really cool, and handed it to your boss after you highlighted the number ones, or whatever.
Exactly.
My question is, how many people in that company thought of Wednesday at 5:30 as a really good time to bang out sick at 3:30? Like, were they either like, I am winning today, or was it, God, just get me out of here before somebody asked me why my guy is not on the top of the list?
Oh, yeah. No, that was definitely a thing. But I remember I knew I had to be at my desk at 5:30 on Wednesdays. No running out to happy hour early. I was there for those lists, but yeah, it was definitely a thing. And of course the New York Times bestseller list is still a thing. But yeah, those were the heydays for sure.
Well,
yeah,
James,
I remember, and go ahead.
James Patterson comments aside regarding the New York Times. Tell me or tell us what the differences are between what you did back then, because you said, you know, everyone's job was to try to get their books on the New York Times bestseller list in 96, versus what tips and tricks are you doing now that are different, and what has stayed true? Like, what did you learn back then that you're still able to do now?
Oh, that's a great question. So, you know, I remember with Putnam, the author tour was a big thing. So when you had a book, the house would plan a massive tour. So like, an Alice Hoffman, it would be, okay, we're going to send her to 20 cities. And so
we would pay for it.
Yeah. I mean, and it was like a whole thing, like going to, you know, staying at the Four Seasons and going, you do the bookstore, the great bookstore in every market. And our goal as publicists was to get the local NPR in each market, get Good Day Atlanta or Denver or whatever the local TV show was, and then get a feature, like a major feature, in every newspaper. And, you know, it was very possible. When we would send authors to Denver, it would be like, okay, now we can't have both, so are we going to go after the Rocky Mountain News or the Denver Post? And then it'd be like, okay, how many, you know, which one do we think has more subscribers? You know, if we had a choice. But it was really that level of local publicity. And then you would, you know, you'd have your publicity rollout. So people who lived in Denver, for example, would open their newspapers. They'd say, see, oh, so-and-so author is going to be at the tattered cover. They'd see the author on TV. They'd hear the author on the radio. And everyone would go to the bookstore and buy the book. So
today.
Yeah. And now we are today where we have very little book coverage in any of the newspapers. You know, we're struggling. Newspapers are struggling for subscribers, struggling for eyeballs. And I think everyone is just, everything is so fractured. And the honest truth is we don't know how to capture people's attention and get them into bookstores because, I mean, I think people are really not that motivated to go to, you know, they work all day, they, whatever they're doing, to get themselves across town to a bookstore to hear the author speak and to buy a book. I think you get your friends. I think you get your family to come. But I think it's really hard unless you're at that top celebrity level when you have such a massive following that those fans, those readers show up for every event that you do.
So did Amazon kill it or just create a different method of distribution?
I don't think it's Amazon. I would like to think that people are still buying books. I just think they're buying them in a lot of different ways that doesn't turn into the traditional hardcover book buy that we used to count on as an industry. I think people are, my dad is a big reader. He reads on his Kindle app on his phone in the gym. So he's not interested in physical books. But he's buying books, he's consuming books. So that's a good thing because he's a small business owner and he doesn't have the bandwidth to sit and read leisurely, but he does, you know, the 45 minutes when he's in the gym. So.
Or stroll the bookstore. Like that was one of my favorite things to do, like through college and even the first up until 9/11, but I mean the e-readers really didn't take, but even during my academy days, I'd bail at night and go walk around in Barnes & Noble for a couple hours, just grabbing books. And it's, once that e-reader hit, especially when you're traveling and all the life's happening, it's like, it's just so easy, but the browsing's different. Like it used to be, you just go wander the books with a bookstore with a cup of coffee and it was awesome. And outside of having the two little guys, they won't give me 5 minutes to walk browse an aisle, but you miss it. Yeah. And the sad thing is, like you're saying, I don't think the generation has ever gotten the exposure to understand how great it is to walk a bookstore and just get to know the books you're surrounded by. That's sad.
Right. Right. And that discoverability and the independent bookstores that are still here are thriving because they really have, they figured out how to do it. They have a dedicated, audience and who goes to those stores wanting those recommendations. And it's so fun. I mean, I went into a bookstore when I was back east this past summer in Maine, and I went into this little bookstore and I just surrendered to it. I just said, okay, what should I read? And she found this great book about that was historical fiction. It was set in Maine. And I would never have thought of it if I hadn't put myself out there and asked for it. So
no, that's the great thing about the small indie bookstores. I worked in one in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And, you know, they write little note tags next to each one, you know, somebody local and then, oh, so-and-so's favorite. And this is, they'd even write like a small synopsis, like three sentences and why they liked it. And that is just such an experience. But what about today? Okay. So before John asks his next question, let me ask.
Yeah.
We have a lot of writers who listen to this podcast, obviously. Yeah. What do they need to do to break into getting, if they're not Jack Carr or, you know, Lee Child, what can they do to get their name out there or get their books seen?
Yeah. Well, it's, I think every author needs to understand you can't, it's not an overnight thing, and no one can go from 0 to 100. That it's really about, but you also have to do all the basic building blocks. And if you don't have them, you're not going to get to where you ideally want to be. But I mean, just an aside, you know, I think of Jodi Picoult as a great example because, you know, she's a huge number one New York Times bestselling author. When I was working at my agency I started there in 1997. One of my bosses was working on the publicity for her first book. I mean, it's sort of like we were talking before with Lee Child, and Jodi Picoult was a nobody, but she wrote really good books. She worked really hard. Our agency worked really hard for her, and book by book, she became more well-known. She built her audience. She started to get bigger reviews in more prominent places. And it, you know, it's over that time span that she became who she is today, Jodi Picoult. So
but I you do said think it you, takes time. Okay. So take the time. Two things. You mentioned building blocks.
Yeah.
One, what are some of those building blocks that they can do? Sure. And two, publishers don't give you a chance. If you have a 2 or 3 book deal, yeah, and if book 3 doesn't take off, you're gone.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And I think it's terrifying. And that can happen on every level when you can have a major deal at a big 5 publisher and you can be dropped because you're not earning out the advance. So yeah, I mean, that is a scary reality for sure.
Right. What are some of those building blocks then?
Sure. Okay. So some of them to me seem obvious, but I'm still finding, I spoke to an author the other day who just hadn't thought that maybe she's got her debut novel coming out next year and she just hadn't thought about a website. And so having a really good author website is so important. And I'm not talking about like a fancy bells and whistles website. I'm just talking like clean, clear design, fits your brand. And we can talk about what that means for an author, but with up-to-date information. So many major authors, I've gone on their websites and their last information is like 2018. I'm like, yeah, your website, yeah, is your ground zero. I know Instagram is hot, TikTok, all those things. Like, you still, that's your home base. That's where people are going to go to hopefully get the most current information about you as an author. So I think that's really important. I think doing a good author photo is so important, and doing, you know, not just like a iPhone photo on the fly, like really investing in, you know, if you're female, hair and makeup, getting a professional photographer, getting options. And again, doing them so they fit your brand. Like if you're doing really like dark, edgy thrillers, I've seen authors do like kind of cutesy photos with their pets. Like, don't do that. Do what yeah, fits.
Stick to the brand.
Yeah. Hearts and sunshine. Yeah.
She dies in the basement out in January 2025.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like a brand seems very like not artsy and very consumer-ish, but it's true. And with anything you're putting out in the world, you have to know what your brand is, understand it, and stick to it.
Awesome. Love it. So get a website, get a good author photo.
Yeah, and many other things to do, but
that's Well, I think you
and hire your PR firm.
Yes, exactly. Hire NBC Communications.
No. And I will say this: not everyone needs to hire a freelance publicist. A lot of authors do, but not everyone does. And there's a lot you can do yourself, and there's a lot you can do to make the most of whatever resources you have at your publisher.
Well, do you offer like a consult, like, hey, just take a look at what I'm trying to do and just give me a thing versus a full blown out, you know, Megan experience?
Yeah, I have done like 1 hour consultations where, you know, they just kind of need like an overall look. And yeah, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah. But and that was one of my questions. Like, this last example you said, you know, they've got a debut novel coming out and it didn't occur to them that they need to have a platform. They need to have that base. Has there ever been like a time where you just have to sit down an author and just have this come to Jesus moment of you are in a brand new world now. This is what's required of that world. Are you able to do this? Because just from my short experience as an author going to different conferences and mixing it up with different people, like that's you'd see at these big conferences, table day, and there'd be this person just grumbling and sitting at their table, just angry at the world because they haven't sold any books. And it's like, you're not here to sell books. You're here to meet people and you're here to generate interest. You're not getting rich doing this. Like, and it's not my job to tell somebody that, but it has been like, hey, you know, you're not here to sell, make money, just have fun. And like yes. In your profession, how many times have you had to like reveal the real world to people?
Oh my God. So frequently. Yeah. And that's such a good point, John, because those conferences, any author I'm working with who's thinking about going and hasn't been, I say like, do not go there with that intent of selling books. That is not what it's about. It's about building relationships and making friends. And I mean, that's the fun of it. I mean, I met Jeff in person at BoucherCon last year and we had a blast. And I met so many cool, interesting people. I was so, it made me feel like I really was part of the mystery thriller community, which, you know, that's why we're in this. I mean, sure, everybody wants to make money, but you know, it's good. It's good for the soul too. So.
Yeah. And I, you know, not to talk a ton of business, but like, another group, you know, you'll talk to people and they'll be like, yeah, I tried to do this. I tried to do that. And they wanted this enormous amount of money to launch my book. It's like, there's a whole lot that goes into it. Like you were just talking about, we, you know, your spectrum at one point was NPR, the local paper, the local TV station, a three spectrum front. Now the spectrum is some chucklehead book talk influencer on one side and an actual journalist on the other. And all of that requires a whole lot of energy and work, but to explain to somebody who has no understanding of what they're walking into, the commitment and cost is, you know, people love to complain and they're going to complain about marketing and they're going to complain about publicists. And it's like, no, there's a reality here. If you don't understand. Like,
no, you make a great point. And I think that's one of the many challenges of what I do is so much of it is like, it's like a tip of the iceberg. Because I have the results that I deliver, but the client, and I do my best to make them aware of what I'm doing. But if I'm doing too much reporting about all the things I'm doing, I'm not doing the actual doing. So I think and this is advice for any author working with a publicist, it has to be trust-based. You have to be like, I know she gets me and I know she's going to do everything she can because I'm going to get what I get, but I'm also will have tried all those other things that just simply don't pan out for whatever reason. And that's really frustrating to not get answers. Cause I think if we got an answer from everybody we pitched as publicists, it would be helpful. Like, I'm not doing it because for whatever reason, but usually a no is a no answer. And that's really hard for authors to accept and to understand. And it's frustrating for me too. So I was going to say something else about what you brought up, but now I can't remember what it was. Anyway.
You remember as soon as we hang up.
Yeah.
All right. So related to that, like you just said, like you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, but in my experience watching, and I think who were we talking about this with? Simon, maybe a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it might've been Greg, but we were talking to Greg Podolsky, and one of the stats he threw out is still sitting with me. Yeah. The day his debut novel comes out, 2,200 other books get launched on Amazon at the same time. So not only are you fighting, you're one in 2,200, but not only that, but you got to hope that eyeballs care enough to stop on your cover, because if you're scrolling Amazon, that's all you see is a cover. You're not walking through and grabbing one. And just the energy that you have to be in that marketing game and the publicity game, it's got to be exhausting. So is it, this might go a little back, but did you understand this getting into the career? Like, were you always that like kind of person's like, yeah, I'll take this and fight the entire wave myself and figure out how to make this person popular? Or was it a realization for you when you entered this industry?
That's a good question. No, I just heard that it was like, there were really fun book parties, because in 1996, everybody had a book party, and I heard, oh, book parties, that sounds good. Okay, that's a good job for me. I think it was, it's just, in the beginning, it seems like it was easier. Maybe I'm sure there were other challenges, I can't remember, but I think yes, it's very frustrating. It's very challenging. I hate to not get answers, especially when I really believe it should be yes. Meaning if someone who's, let's see, if the book's a romance, shall we say, it's probably not going to be a fit for like a hard news outlet. So that's something I'm not even going to pitch, because my reputation is important, and I'm having these conversations with media people, and I need them to know that I know what I'm talking about, and I'm only going to bring them things that they're going to hopefully want. But I guess what I wanted to say in a roundabout way is, you know, if I really believe something should happen, it's not that I'm not going to take no for an answer, but I'm going to pursue an answer until I get one. And that's going to take whatever it takes. So,
yeah. And it just seems like it's just such a self-driven thing. Like, it's not everybody is a self-starter, and not everybody is independently going to focus and attack something. So it just seems like it's kind of a rare person that will just keep going in a vacuum. Like what you said, usually the no is the no answer I guess this question is probably for anybody who wants to do what you do. 'Cause you know, there's tons of people out there that absolutely love books and would love to do nothing more than just shout it from the rooftops and make people famous.
Yeah.
But it takes a certain person to do that. Like, you can't sit at your desk and wait for leads. You have to attack doors. And
yes.
I don't know. I guess advice for people looking for that life.
Yeah. No, I think it's a lot of juggling, because I'll be doing one thing and then someone will send me or call me about something urgent and I'll be pulled. And so I'm always working on like 10 things at once, like 5 things and then another 5 things in my head on multiple projects. But that's fun, because it's never dull. It's always interesting. I think it's a lot of like being able to juggle, being able to see like, okay, what's priority? I got to go. That has to be done now. That has to be done in an hour. That can wait until tomorrow. Being organized. And this is something I'm not good at, but not taking things personally. I still take it personally all these years later. If someone says no, I take it personally.
Oh yeah.
That's because I really believe in the books that I represent. I've read them. I've thought about them. I've worked closely with the authors. I really deeply care.
Do you turn stuff down that you just don't think you can get behind?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Things that I know are good for somebody else, but I just wouldn't read as a regular reader. Like I only want to work on things that I would recommend to my book club or recommend to a friend who says, what should I read next? And also books that I feel like I really get, because there are many books that I, you know, that are excellent books, but are just not in my wheelhouse. So.
Hey, so you're in LA. Do you only do books or have you turned down Brad Pitt?
I only do books. I don't know how to, others have said, oh, PR is PR. You could do movies. You could do film. Right. I don't know. I really love, for all the quirks, for all the frustrations, I really love publishing, and I love all the characters. And
well, speaking of quirks and frustrations and characters, before we hit record, I know you just dropped the bomb on all these writers and everything. So give us one story, if you can, about somebody who just really stepped in it. I mean, or, you know, just I absolutely don't ever do this kind of moment from a writer when you're behind the scenes and you're working so hard and you got everything lined up and then something just really goes sideways. Anything like that?
Oh, God. Let me think.
I mean, you got some big names out there, like, you know, Robert Degoni.
That time Lee Child really insulted The View.
What happened?
Yeah, exactly.
Bob Degoni does everything right.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He does everything right. Let me think. I have to go way back in the mental vault for that. Gosh, I mean, honestly, my authors and of recent years have really been so well behaved. I'm sure there's
something you've seen, like another publicist or another, just some writer you didn't even know they did what?
Oh gosh. Yeah. I don't want to bring up anything too recent, cause you'll all know who it was.
No, that's fine. How about this? What should John not do? Moving forward, because he's got a lot of books out there and he's working on some new series. Like give John a little bit of free advice or what should he not do.
And caveat, I have been known to run as fast as I can into a brick wall. So
nice.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that there's certainly been some, this is not about you, John, but there's been bad behavior at, mystery conferences in recent years, which has been, and not just by the men either. There have been some women too. So, yeah.
So be careful out there, people.
Yeah, I did wanted to go jumping off the waterfalls at the Gaylord, but I was on the this Nashville, is my first one. So this is the first one. I had to be on my best behavior. I was like, I don't know these people, so no shots this week. No
cannonball.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you should always, you know, follow decorum, behave yourself. Okay, so John, what do you tell me? It'll be like a, you know, Dear Abby Collins show. What are you struggling with right now? Like, what's your thing when it comes to marketing and PR that you're like,
Oh, I was whining about, I'm trying to learn Amazon ads over this past year, just playing with the keywords and the algorithms and all that nonsense. Yeah. But it comes back to like Greg's thing, you know, 2,200 books a day, born writing in the thriller genre, which I think is, if saturated is a word, it's not strong enough. My wife actually just like 2 years ago was like, we're sitting around with a bunch of authors who think of things in business sense. And she's getting notes from all these people. She's like, why don't you do any of that? And I'm like, well, I'm just writing the stories I want to write and I'll figure out the rest of it later. So I think I have shot myself in the foot from the beginning because I looked at it more as a art than a business. So I'm figuring out the PR and the marketing and all that stuff in the back end, 8 books in. Yeah. Doesn't help sales, but I'm having a great time. So it's, I don't know, it's weird, right?
Well, it is. I mean, it's tricky because you do want to, walk that line. You don't want to just be like, okay, what's going to be trendy a year from now? Cause I want to write that. You do want to write what you're excited about and what is a story that you would read. I mean, it's sort of going back to what I was saying, like you want to write those stories. But it certainly doesn't hurt to have the marketer in the back of your head. For example, you know, when there's when you're writing about something, say it's historical fiction and you're writing about an event that happened in the past, if a true event, if there's an anniversary or something coming up that you can tie to, like have that book published around the anniversary, because in my experience, the media is always up for an anniversary, you know, the 80th anniversary, World War II, you know, these things are sort of help a busy journalist slot in a story. And that's always, of course, easier with nonfiction, but I work on mostly fiction, so I'm always looking for the angle. Anniversary, I mean, I saw you have a background, FBI background?
Yep.
Yeah, so like that's really cool that you're writing about what you know, real life experience. To me, as a reader, much more interesting than a writer who's making it up.
Yeah, we've that's come up a bunch. A lot of people in the community just bring that background to their writing, which is interesting. You know, it's different. I mean, some of the big names from before, like Clancy was an insurance salesman. Elmore Leonard was I think he was an insurance guy too. But I mean, they were just amazing at what they did. But you know, now we've got Jack Carr, we've got Simon Gervais, we got name it, Stewart, an F-18 pilot writing massive thrillers. It's wild. It's great to have that context, you know. But I did, and I know we gotta wrap up in a minute. But I have two questions, and so I'm still stuck on when you were printing off the New York Times bestseller list. Did you ever see like somebody called on the carpet because who was supposed to be in the top five, their guy was like in 40th, and like they couldn't escape the office before 5:30, so the boss was like, "What's with your numbers?"
Ooh, well, okay. So I'll tell you two stories based on this. Okay. One was, there was a book, it was something with the magician in it, the magician something, but it was one of those books we were talking about earlier, where it was, this book was, everyone from the top down said, this book must be a bestseller. And for whatever reason, it wasn't working. Maybe because it wasn't that good. I don't know. But it wasn't working. And I remember we in publicity were brought into a room and the big boss was like, okay, you, why haven't you pitched the AP desk at like the St. Louis Bureau? Or, you know, there were like these like really weird, very tangential story angles that she was like, why haven't you done that? Why haven't you done that? Why haven't you done that? And how I can take myself back to my, you know, 27-year-old self and imagine what it was like to be like, oh my gosh, she's going to point the finger at me next for not doing. And that was just such a terrifying situation when, you know, we're supposed to be like championing books and being excited about them. But back to the bestseller list. So I remember the very big boss, the publisher of Putnam at the time, she asked me her assistant trotted down the hall and said, she needs four copies of each hardcover fiction, paperback fiction, and nonfiction. And she needs them right now. So I'm like trying to figure out the photocopier, which was, you know, those like old, big, huge monsters that you're like, not working. So I made my copies, organized them, rushed them down, gave them to the assistant. And then like 5 minutes later, the big boss comes like tromping down the hall. Like everyone had vacated the whole department. And it was just like, you could hear the boots coming down. So she stood there and I had probably been working maybe a month. I just was like just into my job. And she stood there and screamed at me and F-bombed me because I had mixed up the papers. So I'd put a hardcover page in with the paperbacks and she'd gone through them and the list was not right. And she just stood there and screamed at me. Oh. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to last very long in this business.
It's like, what am I doing? What am I doing here?
Yeah.
Awesome. to keep you to commute time. And I had one more question about dealing with book talk influencers, but I'm not going to make you jump into that pool.
You tell me how to deal with those people.
I don't want to. I try to get on that hashtag. I'm like, oh, these guys are annoying. I'm like, I'm out. So that's
my parting advice on that. Not every author needs to have their own TikTok book talk account. That's not what it's about.
I don't
want to. Let the book talkers do what they do. Y'all write good books. If you want to do TikTok, great, but don't do it because you think that's how you sell books. And that's really for all social media. Don't do something because you think it's going to, or maybe for everything. Do it because you think you're going to sell books.
That's great advice. That is
good advice. And I feel like I'm off the hook and I can delete my TikTok account now.
Yes, I know, right?
but and that's meganbeedy.com. MBD on X and MBC_books on IG.
That's right.
Awesome. I got it right. I don't always get it right, but thank you very much for joining us, and I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right. See you, Megan. Hey, thanks.
Hey, bye.
Circle. All right. Good night, everybody.